Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take a look at one of the big stories of 2013, because it was this year that a new study and a new position paper released suggested that tens of millions of Americans not currently on statin drugs should be taking them. We're going to talk to an expert. He has been a guest on Health Talk, and he's rejoining us today. He is Dr. John Abramson. Dr. Abramson is a professor at Harvard University. He has served as chairman of the Department of Family Practice at the Lehigh Clinic in Massachusetts. And he's an American physician who's author of a great book entitled Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. He currently teaches medical students in the field of primary care medicine, and he has some distinct views on the new guidelines. So without further ado, here's Dr. John Abramson. Dr. Abramson, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Ron, it's a pleasure to be back with you. Just a couple of comments to update some of the biographical information. I teach at Harvard Medical School. My formal academic appointment is lecturer in healthcare policy. So I just want to correct that so people aren't misguided.
Absolutely. Let's get it. Let's update your resume. Okay. So actually, you have been a bit of a critic of the indiscriminate use of statins, and we'll clarify what we mean by indiscriminate, because you were the author, and it's one of the reasons why we talked to you a few years back, of a landmark article that created quite a stir. Back in January 2007, you wrote an article entitled, Are Lipid-Lowering Guidelines Evidence-Based? And you wrote that for a major world medical journal called The Lancet. Tell us what you concluded then.
Well, what Jim Wright and I wrote, had published in The Lancet in 2007, was a critique of the 2001 guidelines, United States guidelines, that inform doctors about who should and should not be put on statins. Those guidelines had increased, in one fell swoop, the number of Americans for whom statins are recommended from 13 million to 33 million.
So that was actually the first escalation back way back then.
Yes, it was a near tripling. And I want to correct just one thing you said.
Sure.
I am a critic of indiscriminate use of statins, but I'm much more a critic of indiscriminate recommendations by expert panels about the use of statins, which is a much more serious problem.
Okay. Yeah, and there's, I get the kind of a nuance in terms of that, because I guess what you're driving at, if I hear you correctly, is that you think it should be an individualized choice made by a doctor in consultation with a patient, and not based on kind of a cookie-cutter recommendation or some kind of algorithm.
Well, yes, but there's a couple steps in between that are really important, Ron, and this is really the guts of the matter. Drug companies fund most clinical trials. In fact, all of the major clinical trials of cholesterol-lowering drugs, cholesterol-lowering statins, all of them have been funded by the drug makers. So experts making recommendations and doctors making recommendations for their patients need to rely on the integrity of the reporting of that data and the integrity of the process by which the expert panels make national recommendations to inform doctors. The problem is that although those recommendations in 2001 were claimed to be evidence-based, they were not. And in fact, the guidelines themselves in 2001 admitted they were not. And millions of the 23 million Americans for whom statins became recommended in May of 2001 because of those new guidelines were women who did not have heart disease. And it's a 284-page document, the full document. Towards the end of that document, the experts actually admit that there's not evidence, there was not evidence to support the recommendation for putting women without heart disease on statins. In other words, they were not telling the truth that they were providing evidence-based recommendations. They were providing opinion-based recommendations. It's not fair because practicing physicians don't have the hundreds of hours and the statistical skills that are required to go through this data to find out that the experts are projecting their opinions, but not the evidence-based the published evidence that they claim to be representing. So practicing physicians are in a double bind, a triple bind, really, because A, the information they're getting is not honest from the experts, and B, if they don't follow those recommendations and somebody has a heart attack, and heart attacks do happen, even if they were not preventable by statins, they happen. If they don't follow those recommendations, the patient or the patient's family can come back and sue the doctor and present those guidelines in a court, and the judges are very reluctant to get into the weeds of a scientific argument. They accept the expert panel as the facts.
Well, you know, that's actually very interesting because I didn't attend this conference, but a colleague of mine told me that he had attended a medical conference wherein there was not a scientific panel, but there was actually a legal panel, a bunch of lawyers sitting on a table in a conference room offering legal guidance to doctors about when to prescribe statins. And basically what they were saying is you better cover a certain part of your anatomy because the guidelines are stating that it's advisable to put patients on statins. So if you don't put patients on statins, you might get yourself sued.
That's exactly right. So when I lecture to physicians, I know I've gotten across when one or more physicians comes up to me afterwards and says in a distressed way, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And what my recommendation is, to get back to a point you were making about individualizing therapy, what I recommend that physicians do is individualize therapy by partnering with their patients and helping their patients to understand the shades of gray involved in the decision about whether or not to take a statin. It's not like a light switch, like when you fall into a certain category, all of a sudden everybody who takes a statin is going to benefit and everybody who doesn't take a statin is going to be harmed. So the best example is a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 1996. It was the first study that showed that very high-risk men who do not yet have heart disease benefit from taking a statin. And these were amongst the highest risk men in the world, west of Scotland, and 44% of them smoked, and their average LDL, bad cholesterol level, was 192. It was a very high risk population. And what this study found is that there was a significant reduction in the risk of heart attack if men were treated with a statin or not, and almost a significant reduction in the risk of death if men were treated with a statin or not. But when you turn the microscope up on that significant finding, the truth is that amongst the highest risk primary prevention men in the world, the men who don't already have heart disease, you have to treat 50 of those men for 5 years to prevent one heart attack. Now, that doesn't translate into a yes or no answer. If, as a family doc, a patient would come to me and say, "Doc, should I be on statins?" they might fall into the category of qualifying for statins based on the guidelines, and I would tell them that. And then I would tell them that the data shows, the best scientific evidence shows, that if I treat 50 men like you for 5 years, one will benefit by not having a heart attack, and the other 49 won't benefit and will be exposed to side effects.
So I know there's 49 people would be treated unnecessarily with the risk of side effects. And that boils down to a very important concept in medicine, number needed to treat, or NNT. So, you know, you're out there studying various medical procedures and various medical drugs. Does an NNT of 50, does that make sense in the world of medicine? What are the criteria by which drugs are generally approved or surgeries are generally considered valuable? Is the NNT usually lower, like more like 10 to 1 or 5 to 1 when it comes to making a decision about doing something?
Yeah, so this too can't be cookie cutter run. There are several factors. Number one is there an alternative way to achieve the goal that doesn't have any risks?
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, yes. There's a much better way to achieve the goal, which is to adopt a healthy lifestyle, which includes exercise, moderate or vigorous exercise on most days of the week, and to adopt a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, not smoke, don't drink in moderation. The World Health Organization says that about 80% of the risk of heart disease has to do with how we live our lives. So if you're talking about reducing the risk of a heart attack by 2% over 5 years, or addressing 80% of your risk of heart disease, I think most rational people would choose the latter. Now, some people will say, well, you know, doc, I'm lazy and I'm busy and I'm stressed and I got two jobs. I don't have time to do those things, so just give me the statin and let me achieve let me do it by pill. I'll pay for it, let me just take a pill. Fine, but the pill doesn't work so well. So the first question is, are there alternative ways to achieve the same goal? Second question is, what are the harms? Because every medicine has benefits and harms, and you've got to balance the two.
Let me just interrupt you there, because I remember quite vividly a few years back, and I think it may have been when that first study came out advocating that more men take statins back in 2007. It was quite a few years back. I was watching the Today Show, and I had a guy on. I think he was president of the American Heart Association, a very distinguished-looking physician. And they asked him, you know, what about the potential downsides or side effects of statins? And he said, they are exceedingly rare. He says they may occur once in perhaps 50,000 patients taking that. And I just laughed to myself and I said, that's ridiculous, because in my own practice, where I see perhaps a few hundred patients, I can think of dozens of patients who report side effects of statin drugs. And if that's the case in my, you know, relatively small practice, there are probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individuals with side effects due to statin drugs. So please continue on that theme.
Absolutely, and the evidence shows that to use that doctor's number of 50,000, 10,000 will have side effects.
Yeah.
The rate's about 20%. Mm-hmm. Some are mild, muscle pain, easy fatigue, tiredness, sexual dysfunction that resolve quickly when you stop the statins, and some are serious and some don't resolve when you stop the statins. So the number needed to treat that we were talking about is 50. For very high-risk men. Now, of the primary prevention men who take statins, we're talking, I'm going to make up a number, but probably the highest 5 or 10% risk group of the primary prevention men. So very high risk, you have to treat 50 to benefit 1. What's the number needed to harm? 20.
Yeah.
So you're going to prevent a heart attack in 1 out of 50. You're going to cause symptoms, adverse events of various seriousness in 1 out of 20. But the bottom line here is that the article that we just had published in the British Medical Journal, we took the drug company data and reanalyzed it and found that for people who have less than a 20% risk of heart disease over the next 10 years, which is the vast majority of people who don't have heart disease, there is not a significant reduction in the risk of dying. A statin doesn't reduce your risk of death. And although a statin does slightly reduce your risk of heart attack, it does not reduce your risk of overall serious illness, because that in the 1 out of 140 people who don't have a heart attack over 5 years, they're going to have another kind of serious illness that replaces that heart attack. So the net benefit of taking a statin for people with less than a 20% risk over the next 10 years of a heart attack is the net benefit is zero, and you're left with this 20% risk of adverse events.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, the downsides may ultimately outweigh the upsides in terms of benefit. Now, it's important, I think, at this point to introduce a couple of terms that we throw around a lot in medicine. for our listening audience. And these terms are primary prevention, secondary prevention, and then I'd like to have you define the term extrapolation. I think you'll do a good job of helping clarify those.
Well, I want to thank you for helping me to protect your listeners from my geekdom.
Right. Well, you know, we tend to, I mean, we lapse into this type of terminology, and
yes,
it's confusing. And but
yes,
I think these are really important concepts, and they're very simple. And I think even many doctors are confused about the distinction between those terms. So let's tackle that.
Okay. So primary prevention means people who do not have heart disease. It means trying to prevent people from having their first episode of heart disease or stroke. And secondary prevention means that people have already had a heart attack or stroke, and we want to prevent them from having a recurrent episode.
Okay, so let's clarify a little more, because a guy who's walking around who has very high cholesterol, maybe, you know, let's take a number, you know, grab it out of the hat, a cholesterol of 300, and maybe a lousy HDL, an HDL that's like 35. So technically, if you give a statin to that guy has not had a heart attack, he doesn't have angina or heart pain, he doesn't have any abnormal, you know, stress tests, that guy is considered healthy, a healthy person, not a person with heart disease. I think a lot of people think if you have high cholesterol, you have heart disease. So that's the definition of heart disease is high cholesterol. That's not the same thing, right?
That's true, Ron, but let's be very precise here.
Okay.
Because you're not totally against statins, and
no,
I'm
correct.
Not totally against statins.
Exactly.
And we don't want to give the wrong message
yes.
to your listeners.
Yes.
You can't just throw it all out because you're going to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Thank you.
So let's be clear.
Thank you for clarifying. Yes.
Yeah. So for secondary prevention, people who've already had heart disease?
Yes.
A statin is beneficial. How beneficial? Well, you have to treat about 30 people for 5 years to prevent a recurrent heart attack.
Okay, so that's somebody who's had a heart attack or somebody who's had a bypass or a stent that includes that population as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And you have to treat 80 of those people for 5 years to prevent a death.
Mm.
Now, most physicians, you asked the question before, what's a reasonable number needed to treat? And that's really based on a decision that should be made with an informed patient and a doctor. There's not a yes-no answer. Most doctors feel, including me, that those numbers are, that the chance of benefiting, even though it's only maybe 3 or 4% chance of preventing a heart attack, that's a big enough chance of benefit, so it's worth taking the statin if you've had a heart attack or a bypass or a stent.
Also because, you know, the outcome is a particularly bad outcome. You know, it'd be one thing if you're taking a medication that's very potentially dangerous to prevent a headache. You know, you don't want to take a dangerous medicine because the headache is not really all that bad. But a heart attack, very serious, or potentially a fatal heart attack, I mean, these are very dangerous problems. So, yeah, you might want to take a chance and treat some people unnecessarily because the outcome's very serious indeed.
Correct. Now, if you're treating a person for secondary prevention, somebody who's had a heart attack or a bypass or a stent, you're treating them with a statin in the appropriate dose, and they're having side effects, then you want to try a statin holiday, and you may try lowering the dose or going to a different statin. But there are going to be some people who have serious side effects on even low doses of statins, and then for secondary prevention. And then as a physician with your patient, you want to say, look, do you want to hold on to that 3 or 4% chance of reducing your risk of a heart attack, or do you want to get rid of these symptoms? And that really ought to be the patient's decision. It's not the doctor telling the patient what to do. It's the patient weighing how much those statin-related side effects are compromising their quality of life.
Right.
So
because what's the good of, you know, potentially extending your life if you're miserable the whole time?
Right. If you're having muscle pain that prevents you from exercising, if you're having cognitive difficulties, if you're having sexual difficulties, you might choose to go without the statin. That would be a rational decision. But you should make that decision with your doctor, understanding what the risks are.
And, oh, by the way, one of the best ways to prevent cardiovascular disease is because we know that we put patients in cardiac rehab a very short time after a heart attack, is to begin a supervised, carefully appropriate exercise program. And if the statin makes you feel like you don't want to exercise, that's not good either for your heart.
Absolutely, and thank you for bringing me back to that, because that's the message that I want to bring, which is, what are we talking about here? We get focused on statin and cholesterol level. We're talking about preventing heart disease and improving the quality of life. You want to do that, get physically fit. Whether you have heart disease or not, whether you're a healthy person and you don't want to have heart disease, get physically fit. We just always have to keep coming back to that message. All of this discussion is happening because the drug companies are producing the knowledge about how to prevent heart disease, and the knowledge they produce is about how to lower cholesterol with expensive drugs or generic drugs now. But the discussion really ought to be, how do we help patients prevent heart disease and live healthier, more fulfilling lives? We always got to come back to that.
Okay, now let me remind you to tackle the word extrapolation, because you say that they produce these guidelines and studies, and they're not, quote, evidence-based, in your words, that they may be, in fact, based on what's termed extrapolation?
They use that word. So in the 2001 guidelines, it says the recommendations for it says clinical data. I'm not sure these words are exact, but this is what it means. Clinical data to support the recommendations to put women, for primary prevention women, on statins is, quote, generally lacking. Those are the words they use. When I hear that, I think it means they're admitting they weren't telling the truth. But they say clinical data is generally lacking, and the recommendation is based on extrapolation of data from men. Now, as far as I know, men and women are different. And the hormonal
environment
for women...
Last time I checked, too. I mean, I agree.
Yeah, you're still practicing. I haven't seen patients for 10 years. But right. When I left practice, men and women were different, and I assume it hadn't changed. Now, Jim Wright and I wrote in The Lancet in 2007 that we highlighted that they admitted they weren't telling the truth. And there was absolutely no reaction to it. There was one PR blurb that went out to the doctors' websites that said, gee, these guys really don't have the data, they don't really know what they're talking about, and the issue went away. Now, if you look at the fine print in these guidelines that just came out in 2013, they say one of the reasons why they changed the way they do the guidelines is because they didn't have the data for women. So they were lying then. They're not lying now, but they admit they were lying then.
Wow. All right, so let's fast forward now to 2013. This is a year in which there were a couple of epic fails. One, in my opinion, and the opinion of the vast majority of people who watched it, healthcare.gov, obviously a bit of a fiasco. Then there was the release of new guidelines, which are based on something called a heart attack risk calculator put out by the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, the implications of which are that an additional 30 or 40 million Americans, unbeknownst to them, they should be on statin drugs. So
right.
You reacted to that. In fact, I had a hard time tracking you down during the last couple of months because you've been hither and thither and yon, even writing editorials that appeared on the op-ed page in the New York Times, deploring the new guidelines. So what's your reaction?
Right. So let's talk about the difference between the new guidelines and the old guidelines, just so people can understand what we're talking about. The old guidelines, when we started the show, we said that in 2001, the number of Americans for whom statins are recommended went from 13 to 33 million one day in May of 2001. Now, most of those people met three criteria. They had two or more risk factors for heart disease. They had between a 10 and 20% risk of developing heart disease over the next 10 years, according to the Framingham Risk Score. And they had an LDL level, a bad cholesterol level, above 130. Now, the new guidelines have done two things to change that in a very dramatic way. One is they expanded the risk they went from 10 to 20% to 7.5 to 20%.
Which is very low, yeah.
which is very low and adds in maybe 7 million more people. But the more dramatic change, which has not gotten any press that I've seen, because maybe it's just slightly too detailed, but I'm sure your listeners will understand it because it's straight up. They took away the requirement that LDL level had to be above 130. So instead of saying two or more risk factors, 10 to 20% risk over the next 10 years, and an LDL bad cholesterol level above 130, they now say simply, if your risk is 7.5 to 20% mm-hmm. over the next 10 years, you should be on a statin. They took away the LDL criteria.
Now, isn't that a bit of a frank admission that cholesterol doesn't have everything to do with it? That cholesterol in some ways is meaningless, and a lot of people get heart attacks even with low cholesterol?
Well, that's absolutely true, but I think you'd have a hard time getting the experts to admit that that's why they did it. But the point I want to make here is really important.
Yeah.
When you take away the 130, the threshold for putting somebody at risk on a statin, having an LDL of 130 or above, you increase the number of people in that risk category on statins by 60%.
Wow.
60% of people will not have an LDL above 130. So by removing that criteria, they increase the number of people in primary prevention for whom statins are recommended by 60%. That's a huge number. And that hasn't gotten any press.
Well, okay, make it necessary for, they estimate 70 million Americans would be candidates for being on statins. And, you know, I took a very close look at the heart attack risk calculator. And, you know, in some ways it's good. You know, it asks about blood pressure. It asks your total cholesterol. It asks about your HDL cholesterol. It asks you whether you smoke. And it asks about various other factors. It also asks what race you are. And some people have said that, you know, when they took a close look at it, if you are a 50-year-old African-American, virtually 100%, they're going to tell you that you need to be on a statin drug because it's virtually impossible to avoid, you know, due to the mathematical bias towards, you know, African-Americans have more heart disease. They're going to say you're at high risk, so you need to be on a statin. So that if you're a athletic, 50-year-old, slim, a vegetarian African-American man who runs 10 kilometers every day, they're still going to tell you to go on a statin. That's nuts.
Right. That's correct. And in Europe, they use a different kind of score. They call it the Q-Risk 2 score, and they add in socioeconomic status to that, you know, whether, you know, if you're in a poor demographic group because your risk of heart disease is higher. And that's a fact, that a lot of health is determined by where you fit into society. But that doesn't mean you should be taking a statin. And now, I'm not critical that the statin calculator is fine-tuning its inputs a little bit. But I am critical, if we want to defocus for a minute and look at the overall recommendation, now they're saying people between who have a 10-year risk between 7.5% and 20% should be on a statin. And what we wrote in the British Medical Journal and what the editorial that was written that week in the British Medical Journal supported is that there's no net health benefit for those people. So you're getting a little bit into the weeds when you start to look at the risk calculator, what's right and wrong with it, and we're getting away from the message that there's no net health benefit to taking a statin for people with less than a 20% risk in the primary prevention group. there's no net health benefit overall for those with less than 20% risk. There is a 20% or so risk of adverse events, and there are much more effective ways to prevent heart disease. Now, let me get off a little bit on a tangent.
Sure.
Because we doctors and we patients have been fooled the way a good magician fools its audience. It gets you looking at the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask, if we exercise, will that lower my LDL, my bad cholesterol? Will it raise my good cholesterol? If I eat a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, what will that do to my cholesterol? And the answer is, it doesn't matter, because we've been fooled. What matters is, if we exercise, does that reduce our risk of heart disease and improve our chance of staying healthy? If we eat a Mediterranean-style diet, does that reduce our risk of heart disease and improve our chance of staying healthy? It doesn't matter what it does to the cholesterol. sometimes I think when I lecture, I should sell T-shirts that say, "He who dies with the lowest cholesterol doesn't win."
I think that's very interesting. The corollary that I see in my patients, some of my patients, we really successfully delivered the cholesterol message to the public, so that everybody's petrified of high cholesterol. And I have I have patients. Some of them are women in their late 80s or early 90s, and their cholesterol may be, say 250 or 260. I say, you don't need to be on a statin. And they ask me, what vitamin or supplement can I take to lower my cholesterol? And I say, it's not about cholesterol, precisely what you say. If you have a healthy lifestyle, if you're genetically fortunate, if you're on a good diet, if you're slim, many other factors, you don't need to lower your cholesterol if your cholesterol is even a tad high.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And once you get up above 75, even these new guidelines say the numbers are off. I want to go back to a patient you talked about before.
Yes.
You talked about somebody with a very high cholesterol, maybe familial hypercholesterolemia.
Yeah, okay.
With a total cholesterol 300 or higher, and maybe an LDL above 200. The guidelines recommend that people whose LDL cholesterol is 190 or greater, who have tried modification of their lifestyle, and who still have an LDL level of 190 mm-hmm. or greater, be treated with a statin. I don't disagree with that.
And I got to tell you, I have a perfect instance of that, because I have a guy who works in my office, and I know his family, because I actually treat his mother, and they have familial hypercholesterolemia. That's a medical condition where the cholesterol is sky high. It's in the 300s or 400s. And this kid is in his 20s. And I just checked his cholesterol, and I said, "I'm sorry, your cholesterol's 360. I said, "You need to go on a statin." And, he sees me telling all these other patients that they don't need to go on statins. But this guy's got a serious potential medical problem. He isn't as the beginning of cholesterol deposits, under his eyes and on his knuckles, which is a real sign of cholesterol overaccumulation. Those are the people which these cholesterol drugs are designed for, precisely.
Exactly, Ryan. I really tip my hat to you. And listeners, please respect, Dr. Hoffman. You can't just be anti-drug. You got to be paying attention, and what you're hearing from your host is a nuanced, critical evaluation of the medical literature, and that's what you need. You don't want somebody who's going to speak in a monotone against drugs. It's a really important message.
On the other hand, let's take a look at some subgroups that are now eligible to go on statins. For example, you have enunciated in some of your articles particular concerns about giving statins to the, quote, elderly. I think a happier term might be seniors or people above a certain age, where the study results are just not so robust for protection. What about that?
Well, even the guidelines, with all the conflicts of interest that of the experts, their financial relationships with the drug companies, and the bias that I believe is in those guidelines, even they say you back off the criteria once people get to their later 70s. So I think it's important to remember that, and to help your patients understand the senior people, that their longevity and the quality of their life is going to be far more determined by their level of physical fitness than it is by their cholesterol. And in fact, there's some evidence from the Framingham Heart Study that once you get to be a real senior citizen, the higher your cholesterol is, the longer you live. But that doesn't mean that you get it higher by, that's not people who get it higher by eating a bad diet. But cholesterol is not evil in elderly, and we got to remember that the thing is to stay active and to eat a good diet.
Right. It doesn't mean that we take older people whose cholesterol is low and feed them pâté de foie gras and a schmaltz herring or something to get their cholesterol up, because, or chicken fat to raise their cholesterol, because that's not going to help them necessarily.
Right, and the evidence is clear that a Mediterranean-style diet is going to be the healthiest way to eat. But just to defocus on cholesterol.
Yep. And then also women. You have look. There's no question that we have a bias in medicine. We used to tend to ignore women's complaints, and we missed a lot of women who are at risk of heart disease. Sometimes we would just say that they were hysterical or complaining all the time. Weird abdominal pain, aches and pain, shoulder pain, and it turned out they actually had heart disease. So there was a bias against women. Now we say you come a long way, baby. You too should be on statin drugs. We recognize that you too are at risk of heart disease, but you're concerned that women are overtreated.
I'm concerned that women are overtreated, and now I think we've gotten rid of the sexism because now we're going to overtreat the men just as much.
Right.
So the evidence just isn't there to support the benefit for people whose risk is less than 20%. You have to treat 140 of them for 5 years to prevent one heart attack, but you don't prevent serious illness, you don't prevent overall mortality, and the most important negative adverse event of taking a statin is that you're tricking people, or you're participating in the ruse of helping people to believe that they're protected from heart disease, and then they don't do the things and make the changes that would really help to protect them from heart disease.
That's actually one of the criticisms that's been levied against vitamins and supplements lately, is that people take them as an insurance policy against misfortune, and then they don't bother to do the basic work with diet and exercise, which I actually find is a spurious argument, because the vast majority of people I see who take vitamins, they're very health conscious. They tend to do the whole constellation of things that are healthy. There are very few people who I see who are smokers and sit around on their duffs and take vitamins as a means of fending off disease.
But that is the case with statins.
It is the case with statins.
And that's really important.
Because some people feel like they're protected. They say, well, look, I have great cholesterol now, so I don't need to do anything.
Right.
Right. So what's going to happen to these guidelines? Because there was a firestorm of controversy about them, and they even went so far in the Times, and I've never seen this before, and in other papers also. I noticed the big paper in Toronto, the big Canadian national newspaper, they published, this is unprecedented, op-eds which decried the guidelines and suggested that, in effect, that patients ignore them.
Yeah. Now we got to be very careful because it's like a complex weather pattern we're in right now. And let me say, I forgot to say at the beginning of the show, I serve as an expert in litigation, including a case that involves statins. So people need to know that. And if you talk to people who work for drug companies, they should declare that.
Well, if I get in trouble, then I know who to call.
Right. That said, we're in a very confusing time right now. Most of the knowledge that doctors have originates, the upstream source is commercially funded research and articles that are published in medical journals that have commercial funding and expert panels that have commercial funding, at least partially. It's very hard to get non-commercially biased information. And in fact, the drug companies don't even release the data from their studies. We doctors can't get the real data from their studies.
Right.
So it's virtually impossible to know what the evidence really shows. That said, let's take a step back. There's only one statin remains brand name, Crestor. Lipitor went generic last year, and all the other statins have gone generic. So you say, well, what's the big deal here? Abramson is saying there's usually a financial push behind what doctors are presented with as knowledge as the best way to practice medicine. There's usually a financial push to benefit the drug companies, but now all but one of the statins are generic, so what's the big deal here? And the big deal that people have to be aware of is that there are very expensive cholesterol-lowering drugs that some of them have been approved already, and some are in the pipeline, and the estimates from the financial papers are that this market could shoot up to $10 billion a year pretty quickly. So there's going to be some transition of people who are currently on statins or recommended for statins who are going to be so-called statin intolerant, and that may be the first time you've heard it here, listeners, but it's not the last time you're going to hear that phrase.
That's a very interesting projection.
Yep, because you're going to hear the word statin intolerant, because those people are going to be people for whom the guidelines say they should be on a statin, right, who have side effects, and who then need to turn to the very expensive new drugs that are coming out that are going to be on patent.
That's interesting. Yeah. Because it provides the rationale for a whole new raft of drugs. But actually, I actually thought that something else was going on. I thought that, look, these drugs are going to become cheaper and more readily available. And it's so, you know, in effect, how can you increase profits? The only way you can increase or maintain drug company profits overall is to increase the population base taking it. You know, sort of like, you know, what do you do when, you know, less people are smoking cigarettes in America? You find new markets in Asia and Africa, and you import American cigarettes abroad.
But that doesn't quite work, Ron, because it works for the market as a whole, but the players in the market are individually greedy. One company doesn't, the brand name companies don't care a hoot about whether the generic companies are doing well.
Okay.
So it doesn't carry over. And what you are doing is increasing the number of people on statins. But I believe what you're going to be doing is increasing the market, the future market, for these very expensive new classes of cholesterol lowering drugs.
Which are already on the drawing board and, you know, may
soon. Some have been approved already. You haven't heard much marketing, but you will pretty soon.
Wow. That's a fascinating theory. All right. So let's, take a look at one other wrinkle to this, because in practice, what I sometimes do, people come in, you know, because they're aware of your concerns, the concerns you've enunciated that, you know, statins are overused. So some patients come to me and they're pressured by their doctors, to go on statins. And I say, look, there's no way of knowing for sure whether you're at high risk of cardiovascular disease. You seem to have some of the risk factors. I sometimes perform a test called an EBT heart scan. The EBT heart scan measures calcium in the coronary arteries. And some studies have shown that it's actually pretty accurate at predicting the risk of a heart attack. If you have virtually no plaque whatsoever, even if you have a high cholesterol, paradoxically, you know, you might not have a lot of plaque, then there's scarcely any rationale for being on a statin. However, if, as I sometimes discover, patients are chock full of calcium in their coronary arteries, they might be at risk. And it, primary prevention, you know, while in general not paying off, might be worthwhile in those cases. What do you think of that?
The USPSTF, the United States Preventive Screening Task Force, which is the most drug-free source of information we can get, official information that we can get in the United States, says that the evidence really isn't very strong, and that maybe if you're completely on the fence about somebody who is at elevated risk but not very high risk, you might think about doing it, but that it ought not to be a general screening measure. But how about this for a better strategy, Ron? Rather than collecting data that may or may not, you know, you don't know what the predictive value of the results you get are. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the sensitivity or specificity is. What about assuming that everybody's got moderate risk and helping them to make the changes that are going to be far more effective than taking a statin to prevent their risk of heart attack and stroke? What if we all just, look, I just scanned you, and I see you're at moderate risk. Mm-hmm. Now let's do the hard work of figuring out how to help you to make the changes.
Well, yeah, that's what we're all about in the field of preventive medicine, for sure.
Yeah, and when I say that in a lecture, you know, everyone, the docs raise their hand, and they say, well, yeah, but people won't change. And I say, look, I practiced family medicine for 25 years, and I know that it's hard to change, and I know personally it's hard to change in my own life. So when I would have this discussion with a patient and have them come back in a month to see how they were doing, I wasn't bringing them back to see if they changed or not. I knew they weren't going to change. But they would have learned a lot about what was preventing them from changing. And that's when we would start to go to work. Then once you've identified the impediments to change, then you can really help somebody.
Well, I think that's a great way to wrap up this interview because, bottom line, statins may provide us with some measure of false security, But we really should be engaged in a very, very concerted program of prevention of cardiovascular disease. You know, not based solely on you know, surrogate risk factors like cholesterol and you know, things that are measurable, but you know, we should seek to optimize our diets, our lifestyles, and unless we have very high hereditary risk or are already too far gone, we can avoid dependency on medication. Your book, right. Overdosed America, talks a little bit about that.
It sure does. When I left practice in 2002 and had time to really get into the depths of research, I got into the cholesterol, the 2001 guidelines, and that started a process of organizing a group of people, and we wrote a letter to the National Institutes of Health, and we tried to raise a ruckus, and we couldn't do very well. But the critique of those 2001 guidelines stands today, and there is not much information that has changed that. So if people want to get into the details, it's written for the lay public. It's not professional language. But if we've gone a little too fast, and I apologize if I have, and people want to spend some time with this in print, the chapter on cholesterol cholesterol issues in Overdosed America, people will find very helpful.
Okay, great. And I've referenced on Facebook some of the articles that you've written, and you can be found via the Internet. I want to thank you very much, Dr. John Abramson, because, you know, look, it's not easy. I know that you've been subject to probably a lot of criticism from your colleagues, but you've taken a very principled and honest approach to this. And clearly, you know, it's not irrational to sometimes challenge some of the guidelines of mainstream medicine.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with your listeners, and thanks for bringing good information to the public.
Okay, and I want to wish you a very happy new year, and we'll look to you as an authority as the story develops in 2014.
Look forward to it.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.